Support for WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. Whether sending your child to college next year or in 18 years, invest in their future with Busey. Busey, your dream, our promise.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 14th day of September 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. And then a bit later in the program, Eric Snodgrass should join us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Don't forget, you can always find our programs online and listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org. It's public radio for the farming world. And hey, stay with us for the whole hour today if you can for the Commodity Week program. Our panelists today include Bill Gentry of Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. Tommy Grisafi from Advanced Trading. He is in DeMott, Indiana. And Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri Marketing out of Morton, Illinois. Commodity Week, it's our weekly look at what happened in the world of agricultural commodities trading at the CME Group in Chicago.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Speculation is the practice of engaging in risky financial transactions in an attempt to profit from short or medium-term fluctuations in the market value of a tradable good, rather than attempting to profit from the underlying attributes embodied in the instrument. Many speculators pay little attention to the fundamental value of a security or a commodity, and instead focus purely on price movements. Speculation can, in principle, involve any tradable good or financial instrument. Speculators are particularly common in the market for stocks, bonds, commodity futures, currencies, fine art, collectibles, real estate, and derivatives. Speculators play one of four primary roles in financial markets, along with hedgers who engage in transactions to offset some other pre-existing risk. Arbitrageurs who seek to profit from situations where fungible instruments trade at different prices in different market segments, and investors who seek profit through long-term ownership of instruments' underlying attributes. The role of speculators is to absorb excess risk that other participants do not want, and to provide liquidity in the marketplace by buying or selling when no participants from other categories are available. Successful speculation entails collecting an adequate level of monetary compensation in return for providing immediate liquidity and assuming additional risk so that, over time, the inevitable losses are offset by larger profits.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, supporting the next generation of farmers with the Fresh Roots Young and Beginning Farmer Program, offering lending assistance and learning incentives to equip today's newest farmers for a healthy start in their farming careers.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzulo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news.
Support for WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. Whether out of town or out of time, with Busey's mobile, deposit checks, view balances, and pay people and bills from your device.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report for this Friday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, now joined by Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Just up front, Mike, you and I are recording on Thursday evening because I'm driving back from Fargo during the day Friday. So thanks so much for joining me late Thursday evening to take up the marketplace. I do appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Well, tell me a little bit about your thought process this week. After we got through that USDA report, which gave us some really big numbers for both corn and soybeans.
Yeah, after the shock and awe, you mean, Todd?
yes.
I would say that on Thursday, before the report came out, we saw emerging market currencies having their best one-day gains since January as measured in index terms of a key emerging market index. And that was led by Turkey, Russia, Mexico currencies. And that mainly was due to the Chinese-U.S. trade talks being reignited and restarted, along with some strong economic data, both here in the United States and globally. So I spoke to clients and subscribers before the report and said, given where the dollar is sitting, crude oil, and some of these currencies and how they look, and the fundamentals of the macro side, if USDA doesn't feed the supply bear, I think the fund-led short covering could be what we can look forward to as long as we don't have too much harvest progress and harvest pressure, especially in the beans. It seems like beans are more ready right now than the corn in most areas of the country. And so that's kind of how I laid out the situation for clients and subscribers. But then we saw the 7.5% increase in U.S. bean carryover and almost 5.5% increase in corn carryover because of these yields. And you could see very clearly the market was not ready, nor was I, for such a big corn yield number. Market was much more dialed into the big bean yield number and had been buying corn and selling beans for the better part of 3 weeks, essentially. But they had to unwrap that because of how much bigger the corn yield number was, not so much the ending stocks number, but the yield number.
So that's behind us now. As we look into the next couple of weeks and harvest really wrapping up, will there be very much pressure on this marketplace, especially as those beans begin to look for a home?
I don't think there'll be as much pressure if the wheat market can make a low. And I'm starting to promote the idea as we go into Friday's close and go into, which is also Friday at noon, expiration of the September futures. I'll be watching the wheat futures most closely, along with the bean futures. But I feel as though that if the Russian ruble especially and some of these key emerging market currencies can continue to lose to the U.S. dollar, and given the fact that Hurricane Florence is bringing in and opening up a lot more harvest weather issues after this weekend in the models now, that the downside pressure should be mitigated because of this. And we see this in the corn, the December corn, that 350.5 low made back on the July report, right around July 12th, that has held on a closing basis after being challenged two or three times. And kind of similar situation in the bean complex. We have pushed that market down to 810, 811, but we haven't taken out the July monthly lows at this point. And so I really think it's up to the wheat. And I think the wheat has the most to gain because when you look at the report numbers, we actually saw a reduction in U.S. wheat ending stocks, and world wheat stocks to use ratios only went up maybe 0.2% versus August. So I think a lot of it goes back to the wheat because that is hinged upon and is kind of the laser point of what the outside markets want to do. And if the funds want to keep selling, they're going to keep selling the wheat and keep making the technicals in the wheat weak. And I think that's just going to lay on the corn and beans.
What do we know about the South American, or rather Southern Hemisphere wheat crop, Australia, Argentina in particular? And can problems that still exist in Europe, Ukraine, Russia, as it pertains to dry and droughty areas going into the fall for their winter wheat seeding, support the marketplace?
It can if we get the demand, Todd. I think that's what this week has shown us very clearly. Saudi Arabia is looking for about 600,000 tons of hard red wheat. We missed the Jordan tender. They pulled the plug on their tender after the report. We saw the European crop remain pretty much unchanged. We saw the Australian crop drop, probably not enough, in my opinion. And we saw the Canadian crop drop a little bit, but that was more than offset by the Russian crop and the former Soviet Union. So here again, we circle right back around to the currencies and the ruble. And it's not about the price. It's really about just getting the business away from Russia in some way, shape, or form, whether it's because they don't want to sell anymore or because they want to put some export quotas in place, or whether we just finally get into that market in the Middle East. But right now, U.S. soft red wheat's $214 a ton. Ukraine's at $213 a ton. France is at $232 a ton. It's not about the price, but we got to get that demand to change the mindset of the trade, especially given these trade sanctions and no movement yet on NAFTA or with China.
You would really think that that would be important in the United States, the western part of the Corn Belt, thinking, which crop am I going to put in the ground for next year? And that decision needs to be made soon.
Yes, and I think it's going to be wheat. I really have been talking to quite a few producers right now that are looking at wheat again because they had a really good time, especially east of the Mississippi River, of double cropping beans and wheat. And I talked to one producer in central Indiana today, and he talked about doubling his wheat acres. And, you know, that may not seem like a lot, but if you get a lot of the major corn producing states that go from 150 to 300 acres in wheat, that's quite a bit of movement away from the corn market. And I think I said to him, go for it as long as you hedge it when you July 19 futures gets a six in front of it. Don't let that slip away.
Anything for the corn producer at this point? Do they have some potential in the marketplace still? We're not above $2 billion on the carryout.
You could not make this story up, Todd, with the fact that we are trading at roughly 335 in September corn futures, and the fact that the national corn price is trading down around 320, and yet USDA, because of their demand base they've built up both here in the United States and globally, they literally have coarse grain stocks to use ratios at 13% after this month's report. That is lower than 2012, and it's lower than 2006. Corn is right there at about 14%. We did not change the stocks to use ratio at all in corn, and we're still down at the lowest level since 2012. But coarse grains in the world are at the tightest when you factor in demand. It feels nothing like that right now. So yes, when I got before the report, I talked to producers and said, it looks like to me feed grains are the long and oil seeds are the short. After the report, I feel the exact same way.
Absolutely. Hey, so USDA does too, apparently, because they dropped the national average cash price for soybeans by 30 cents. That's a substantial push lower, especially given the number of bushels we believe that were already priced out for soybeans. I would think we'd have to be looking at very low prices maybe for quite some time.
Yeah, and the tougher part of that too is to go in line with what USDA is talking about is we're sitting at 94 million tons of soybean imports into China. That was down one from August. China themselves are saying, no, it's going to be more like 84 at the top end. There's a 10 million metric ton difference. When you're talking about 108 million tons of ending stocks and you've got Argentina sitting on 36 million tons right now, you take 10 million tons off the demand side, that really hurts the bean complex globally. So these numbers all work towards the idea, in my opinion, if you want a really solid soybean turnaround and it's not on harvest problems, you really need to put the low in the wheat, and therefore you get the low in the corn almost immediately because these supply-demand fundamentals in corn are so strong.
If you can run your soybeans across the scale, do you?
I think you have to. I really do think that you can still get about $550, maybe even a little bit more. I'm hearing some yields in Illinois. Haven't heard much out here, but in Illinois, I'm hearing 80-plus bushel yields. And, you know, you take an 875 price against an 80 bushel yield, you're talking about some pretty decent revenue per acre. And I know that's a stretch when it comes to harvest price, but if you would market that, you know, closer to the March or the May, and you have the storage, I would do it that way. But otherwise, yeah, run it across the scale and try and get that 550 dollars per revenue per acre across the scale.
Any good stories on the macroeconomic front or any poor stories, either one?
Well, you know, we're still real vulnerable with Argentina and China, but that the trade talks, if they would go our way in terms of the commodities way, I think that would really take the pressure off the dollar from wanting to go higher. And I think you'd see Argentina and Turkey and China and all their currencies start to really find some support, increase their buying power for imports, and really become less competitive, especially Russia, less competitive when it comes to their wheat exports and their grain exports. So that's the real feature, I think, in the next 3 weeks that we need to watch for, because we really need to get the Chinese deal done by the time we get to the U.S. Midterm elections, in my opinion, because if it doesn't go well for President Trump and the Republican Party, I think the Chinese will dig in, and then you're talking about Christmas and into the new year. That's when you really can create some commodity demand destruction. We haven't seen it yet in these USDA numbers, but China's starting to promote it in their numbers.
Hey, thanks so much, Mike.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend, Todd.
You too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Well, you know, yesterday afternoon, I recorded Commodity Week. Our panelists included Chip Nellinger from Blue Reef Agri-Marketing out of Morton, Illinois, Tommy Grisafi of Advanced Trading, he's in DeMott, Indiana, and Bill Gentry of Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. I asked Bill for his list of questions.
Well, I think the consideration right now after the USDA supply demand report is, do we have to go ahead and stimulate more demand? New contract lows in corn today. How much lower do we really need to press? I think the funds have started to work the short side a little bit more aggressively, and the wheat market's kind of breaking down too. So those two in tandem kind of cause us a little bit of grief, and it might leave the market searching for new lows before it's all said and done, especially since we're only at the leading edge of harvest.
Chip Nellinger from Blue Reef Agri-Marketing, your thoughts?
Yeah, what do we do now? Basis, you know, obviously the China talks that hopefully happen. The biggest is what now that we got this, and is it realistic?
And Tommy Grisafi, what do you have on your list?
I'm really focused on working with the guys up in the Northern Plains, and, you know, as you and I were just up at the Big Iron Farm Show, space is so valuable this year, and understanding how to use space and how to use base contracts or any contract to move a product. And I think I'm actually starting to see panic out in the countryside, and it's concerning. So as we talked about yesterday during the show, that there's no one's ever made a great decision panicking. So what can we do to calm the farmer down?
Well, let's start there, because you say yesterday during the show, and you mean on the Big Iron Farm Show site where you and I both were and have been talking to farmers in North Dakota and from Minnesota and South Dakota, and they really are concerned about what to do with this crop. When they call the grain elevators, many of them, and the further west you go, the more likely this is in North Dakota, are saying, hey, look, we're already all full up. You can bring the soybean bushels you told us you would have here, but everything else has to stay home. So they have to figure out some storage options. What do you think they'll do, and what should they do?
I think they'll beg, borrow, and steal to borrow some more money from the bank. I just got off phone with a farmer who's going to pile a little corn. I think more wheat will make it to town and has already made it to town. So we had that rally in wheat during the right in the gut slot of harvest up there in spring wheat. And so a lot of wheat was priced and brought into town, which gobbled up even more of that room where people thought they were going to bring beans. So beans are the lone man out, and beans are usually people's, what I call money honey, where they bring the beans into town, the cash flow, and then they store the corn and the wheat up there and wait for basis appreciation. So they're going to have to get creative. In the end, some bushels may be sold at a horrible price. A lack of planning, and in general, a lot of people don't have a marketing strategy. They've been blessed with good bushels, and we do tend to hit seasonal lows, and then we start to rally out of it almost every year in beans. So we get down in lower nines of futures, and then we get back to the higher nines, and people move a lot of product. They're not going to have that ability this year. And what Chip was alluding to maybe is that what if we don't get this China thing worked out? So I think 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, farmers were talking, well, when we get this China thing worked out, and now it's, uh-oh,
it could be a while till we get this China thing worked out. And I really start, I just noticed there's a lot of sad faces in the crowd yesterday. And as we had, I had said, you know, you're going to see who's been swimming without their shorts because the tide's going out, and it's going out in a big way. There's definitely no experts in Trump tariff trade wars. So anyone who tells you they know what they're doing is kind of fibbing to you. So we're going to see who knows how to manage space and what money people have to, you know, hold their grain.
Hey, Bill Gentry, he mentioned wheat and it coming to town. When we're talking to producers up here, they really do look to Chicago as the primary place to set the price of wheat. You suggested that market's breaking down. A whole lot of wheat in storage, hard red, soft red, spring wheat, the market really beginning to break down. And is that on just a domestic or a global level? And how concerning should that be for the rest of the marketplace?
You know, I don't think in the wheat market in particular is really that depressed. We haven't made new contract lows there. What I was actually hoping and thinking about in the shadows, we've got a couple of stories. One was the idea that Russia was going to stop exporting some wheat, and then they came back in and said, no, we're going to do fine. And then another guy says they're going to stop exporting. So I think that that bubble's been burst a little bit. Also on Monday, we got revised numbers from the Australian wheat crop down about 13% from the previous assessment. I think those two features were probably too early for the USDA to really engage in this report, and I think that could be looming in the shadows for subsequent reports. So I'm crossing my fingers that the funds don't want to go short the wheat right now. I think the fundamentals are a little bit more positive, but the timing is going to be the issue. And I think realistically, waiting and seeing that come around, I do think that there's probably going to be some wheat acres that go out a little bit more, so that's a little bit depressing. But in the grand scheme of things, the charts really look halfway decent in wheat and a little bit challenged in corn. But I think optimistically, if the funds can continue to maintain their length or their long position and maybe start to build into it, maybe better things will be down the road.
Would you agree with that assessment, Chip Nellinger?
I do. I think that there's a fundamental story there for sure. You know, obviously the Black Sea area, Australia, Europe. I think that was the one disappointing thing out of this report. Was we actually saw an increase in the Russian crop. And I think that really shocked the market. They thought that the USDA would continue to go lower and might have several more revisions lower. But so the increase in the Russian crop, I think maybe was the final straw for some longs. I am worried now with the close that we had on the report day and, of course, corn breaking down, that maybe the funds are going to go through a liquidation mode here and maybe drive this thing ultimately lower than what we would think right now. But longer term, I agree. It just may take a while to kind of see that fundamental story develop. And, you know, again, I think Russia doesn't have a never-ending supply. It might be a few months before the market gets more comfortable that they're out of the market for good. So I do, and I think that'll help corn bottom. But in the short run, I can't find much in this report to hang my hat on that for a reason to rally other than some sort of a, you know, a news story some morning that's a shock on a trade agreement or something like that.
I know it was a turn of phrase, but you make me laugh because it was the one disappointing thing out of this report that you found.
Well, I mean, on the wheat side, I meant wheat specific, the disappointment in wheat. There was a lot of stuff to be disappointed in corn and beans. I'm talking wheat specific.
That, of course, is Blue Reef Agri-Marketing's Chip Nellinger. He was joined on our Commodity Week program by Bill Gentry of Risk Management Commodities and Tommy Grisafi of Advanced Trading. More with them a bit later in the hour.
It's Eat a Hoagie Day. It's also National Cream-Filled Donut Day. Hanson Gregory and American claimed to have invented the ring-shaped donut in 1847 aboard a lime trading ship when he was only 16 years old. Gregory was dissatisfied with the greasiness of donuts twisted into various shapes and with the raw center of regular donuts. He claimed to have punched a hole in the center of the dough with the ship's tin pepper box and later taught the technique to his mother. On this day in agricultural history in 1752, the calendar in Britain and the American colonies jumped from September 2nd to September 14th as the Gregorian calendar was officially adopted, correcting an 11-day discrepancy that existed with most of the rest of the world, which had adopted the Gregorian calendar 170 years earlier. In 1849, Ivan Petrovich Pavlov was born. Pavlov's work with dogs actually started as a study of digestion. He performed a series of experiments on dogs to show how digestive secretions are regulated. Pavlov noted that dogs began to salivate if they were able to see, smell, or taste food. Pavlov suspected that digestion must be partially controlled by sensory stimuli, what he called a conditioned reflex. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Let's check in on the weather now with Agribull's Eric Snodgrass. Eric, what's going on?
Well, Todd, the tropics have been extremely active. At one point in this past week, I was watching 9 separate tropical cyclones moving across parts of the Northern Hemisphere. Now, of course, in the Atlantic, we've had Florence, and we've certainly seen the damage that Florence has done with dumping a lot of rainfall in the coastal Carolinas, and it is not done by any stretch of the imagination. But we're also watching Joyce and Helene out in the open Atlantic. We have Isaac that has now entered into the Caribbean, and there's this little tropical pulse that's coming in towards Texas, all of which we should be discussing. Then get over to Hawaii, they got hit by Olivia, and a very powerful super typhoon named Mangkhut that went right across the Philippines at one point producing 220 mile an hour wind gusts. We've been having for quite some time now a big ridge over Alaska, a deep trough over the West United States, which, by the way, has given us a Canadian storm track. That's why the northern plains have been so stormy, and we've not been so stormy here in the middle part of the country. In fact, that Canadian storm track has also brought snow to Alberta, so it's getting kind of chilly there. Well, that deep trough over the Western Canada and the West United States has basically allowed for a big ridge to kind of push into the eastern half of the country where we are now. Now, the question is, as Florence gets up there and deepens the trough over parts of Greenland, what does that do to our overall pattern as we look forward? Now, I'll tell you this, it helps kind of centralize the cold air in north central Canada and therefore weakens the depth of the trough out west. Now, certainly this is going to take several days to unfold, but what that's really going to do is that's going to give us a shift overall such that maybe by the end of the month, we break down the larger ridge that is sitting over Alaska. Now, what's the translation of all of that? Well, right now, because of the Alaska Ridge, we have a ridge over us as well, and it's cool over the western part of North America. Thanks to that Alaskan ridge, we've enjoyed warm weather. And it's going to hang on for quite some time, maybe deep into the fourth week of September. But the remnants of Florence, plus the shifting changes that we're getting in the Pacific, may break that ridge down into a trough. Translation, the west could warm up, especially western Canada, and that could allow for some of the cold air to be spilling into the Great Lakes states and build into a trough that's over that that region, then moves toward the east coast. Now, that's a stormier path for our systems, and it might actually lend itself toward giving us maybe our first cooler temperatures of the season. Now, this is a long ways away. We're talking way out in the forecast, and predictability has been quite low. But if that does shift, you know, we'll start to see possibly our first frost that come through parts of the northern, far northern parts of the Corn Belt. I'm talking way north. This is not a threat toward Illinois here. In fact, when I stretch out for the next 10 days, I don't see a cooler than average temperature in Illinois really at all. So that's the stuff I'm watching in the pattern. When we kind of just take a look at when is our next chance for rain, well, certainly the storm track that's going to be staying there north of the U.S. border, well, that's going to prevent any cold fronts finally getting down into this area that could lift the air to produce precipitation. But I will tell you this, we do have a shot possibly midweek next week, and then again the following weekend. So we're talking several more days of drier and warmer conditions here, which I think a lot of folks are happy about as we attempt to harvest this crop, which we now know is absolutely huge. So I know there's a lot that we're trying to diagnose here, but it's all playing together, and it's all what we have to do when we try to figure out, you know, how does fall transition, you know, from these hotter temperatures of summer into the cooler weather, and what does rain look like as we move into our harvest time period. And as I finish up here, there's one last monkey wrench to toss into the mix, Isaac. You know, Isaac moved across the Lesser Antilles. We have some forecast model runs that bring it right between Cuba and the Yucatan Peninsula into the Gulf, and that will be one that I will watch all of this end of this week and next week to see if that possibly pulls another Gordon on us, which comes right up the gut of the Mississippi.
Eric Snodgrass is with Agrible.